thinking about why you wrote this book and why this is especially important to you, it seems like this is also pretty personal, right? Like in your book, you write a lot about your family members.
I use my almost 100-year-old grandmother as a framework for the book. She was born in 1919, which is the year before women were given the right to vote. She voted for the first time in the 1960s. She was in her 40s when she voted for the first time. Now, if she was born in 1919, she should have been allowed to vote certainly much earlier than that, at least 20 years earlier than she was. But she's a Black woman who lived in Louisiana. In the beginning of our country, white male property owners were given the right to vote, and it didn't matter if you were a citizen or not, which I think is interesting, right? You could, you know, as long as you were white, a man, and owned property, you could cast a ballot.
Cool. Okay. So that was in the 1700s. And then the Civil War amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th, they gave former slaves, right, the rights of full citizenship, including the right to vote. How did these amendments strengthen Black people's economic power? And then my next question is, like, how did that impact voter turnout and Black people's representation in elected offices?
The period of Reconstruction lasted for less than 20 years, where you did see advances economically, educationally, socially, politically amongst formerly enslaved people, right? But those that only lasted during the period of Reconstruction. So it was a very short period of time. It was a very short period of time before it was systematically dismantled. We also saw that once those protections were removed, that we saw that people of color were no longer allowed essentially to participate in the process. Certainly, in less than 20 years, the protective measures that Congress passed to remedy the dark days and inequities of slavery through the Civil War amendments and other means were essentially eliminated and were rendered impotent to stop the flood of state laws that prevented formerly enslaved persons from exercising the franchise, right? So the adoption of poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses certainly stopped the exercise of the right to vote amongst formerly enslaved persons. As an example, in Alabama in 1890, there were 140,000 Black men who were registered to vote. But in 1906, only 46 Black persons were registered to vote in the state.
Wow.
That's right. The grandfather clause essentially said that if your grandfather did not vote, essentially prior to the passage of the 15th Amendment, then you could not vote. And that's exemplary of the way it happened throughout the South, in places like Georgia and Florida and Mississippi and Louisiana as well. But what are these numbers are actually people, right? They're real people. So when you hear about, you know, a literacy test in the in Alabama, right, you can read about Myrtle Pless Jones in my book, who was a graduate of South Carolina State University and a graduate of Michigan State University, got a grad degree from Michigan State University, an African-American woman, lived and moved to Montgomery, Alabama, where she married and had children. And when she went to vote with her graduate degree, was asked how many bubbles are in a bar of soap before she could register. I'm sorry, before she could register to vote, she was asked how many bubbles are in a bar of soap.
What does that question even mean?
It was a literacy test that was given, and it was completely arbitrary and intended to keep Black and brown people from registering to vote. Another common test was how many beans are in a jar, right? So whatever number you would provide would be the wrong number.
So, like, thinking about the Voting Rights Act, what did that mean for Black voters?
So the Voting Rights Act meant access, right? It meant that in states like Mississippi, where less than 10% of eligible African Americans were registered to vote in 1965. Less than 10%. That's compared to 70% of whites. Right? 6.7% of blacks were registered in Mississippi in March of 1965. After the Voting Rights Act, you see almost parity between black and white voters in very short order, right? So in places like Alabama, and like in 1980s, black voters were registered at about 70%.
Yeah, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also saw the number of black elected officials increased tremendously from 1970 to 1998. So in about 30 years, the numbers increased exponentially. So and that was not just for black elected officials, but also for Latinx officials as well. So for black and brown elected officials, the numbers increased exponentially because of the Voting Rights Act.
Right. Okay. And then in 2011, there was a Supreme Court case, Shelby versus Holder. Can you talk about what that was and how it undermined the Voting Rights Act?
The Shelby County decision essentially eliminated Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, where jurisdictions, those covered jurisdictions, no longer have to make those types of submissions. They no longer have to submit their voting changes. They no longer have to get approval from the federal government before they can implement them.
So basically, there's no oversight.
There's no oversight. There's no oversight. Right.
And so why does this matter? Why does it matter that there's no federal oversight?
Well, I think it matters. And I think we can use Texas as an example again, in that the day that the Shelby County decision was announced, the state of Texas said, we're going to implement this voter ID law. And it was a voter ID law that the Department of Justice and the D.C. District Court essentially said was retrogressive. Economically, it affects people. For example, voter ID laws that are connected to things like driver's licenses, primarily those restrictive voter ID laws that say you have to have a driver's license, a passport, or a military ID. Well, folk who are economically disadvantaged don't have passports. They're not spending money on passports. And in places like Georgia, when Georgia first passed its voter ID in 2006, 25% of African Americans in Georgia did not own a car. Yet the state of Georgia said, oh, you got to have a driver's license as a voter ID. Right. So it's like, so 25% of African Americans don't have a car. Why would they have a driver's license?
Mm.
Although African Americans have been in this country 400 years, we've only been voting for 55.
That's wild when you put it like that.
The measures that have been used to ensure that black people don't have the right to vote has lasted for centuries. Right. We haven't had a century where black and brown voters have been free to vote.